Oh, man. After a week off, I think we were both feeling it after that sheep excursion last week. So we did a rerun.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, though, man.
It was
some awesome hiking. Saw some fantastic sheep. Ridiculous amount of chucker.
Yes. Chucker everywhere, man.
But yeah, it was good. I think the best was the fire pit and bourbon.
The fire pit and bourbon. Yeah, I got to post those pictures. Fire pit and bourbon was good. But you know, that's what the desert is for. That's what hunting camp is for. It's to cut loose and drink a little bourbon, tell some stories. You just attended a commission meeting, right?
Yes, I did. Just attended the November commission meeting last week. Some really cool stuff that's we will, probably do an entire show on.
You said there's enough for a whole show.
Yeah, there's definitely enough for a whole show. There's a lot of discussion about the possibility or future possibility of putting some sheep in some new areas in the state. Some populations that used to be there but aren't now, and now they're possibly ready for reintroduction of some sheep. So that's really cool.
Very cool.
Very cool. And then there's some talk, some pretty deep discussion on recalibrating or recalculating the tag distribution through the three weapon classes, kind of making it more like a rifle class and then a primitive class. And
kind of like Idaho?
Yeah. Primitive would be your archery and your muzzle loader.
Right,
and then
right.
Recalculating the distribution of those tags. It's really forward thinking, in my opinion. It's allowing for more people to get out in the field and get kids a lot more exposure to the outdoors and opportunity. So,
well, I got a million questions, but I know we want to do a whole show on it.
Yeah, I think I will do a whole show on it because there's still some components that I want to research so that I can get better acquainted with the information. So I'm not just like blabbing on and just
spitballing. I think we call that.
Yeah, spitballing.
Loose cruising, freewheeling. all right. I guess we could call this segment housekeeping, commission meeting, and then one to talk about just the amount of birds out in the middle of nowhere right now.
Oh, man.
I mean, it is unreal.
Oh, yeah.
I posted that on Instagram. 4 birds into the day, an hour and a half, no dogs. Everywhere you looked, there were birds.
Yeah.
Every corner I came around up
High,
on that ridge,
low.
There
know,
were
that,
birds.
That one canyon we went into was like bird hunting Disneyland.
Yeah.
It was just
that's a good way to describe
it. Nonstop birds. They were talking all over the place. They were cruising from the top of one hill, coasting across the canyon to the next hill, back and forth, running up, coming down. I mean, we had birds everywhere, and they weren't like dumb younger ones.
No.
Some of the ones
like the size of small chickens, man.
Yeah. Some of those were like, I mean, eggheads and massive bodies on them. They were awesome. I mean, limited out if you would have found the other two.
Yeah, no dogs. Oh,
no,
that's
dogs.
A good point. Yeah. So I shot a limit, but man, I don't know how guys do it without dogs, Dave.
Oh my God. We would have been limited out in
30, 45 minutes max.
If we had dogs.
Yep.
But we were just aimlessly.
I think we were supposed to be sheep hunting. I think that was the deal.
It was. Yeah. We were supposed to be sheep hunting. But when there's that many birds, and then we're done. We're heading back, and we can still
sheep hunt. Yeah.
Yeah, we still sheep hunt. But then when we were heading back into camp, we had all those chucker on the road.
Oh, yeah.
And then they broke off the road 10 feet away from us, and here we are just staring at them like, you've got to be joking me. I mean, these birds are everywhere. And then there's a mountain quail.
That's right. Yeah, you saw the mountain quail running with them. Yeah,
they're
that was pretty
standing
cool.
Standing on the rock staring at us, not even thinking like, you know, limited out, but you could still shoot the mountain quail.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't.
No.
Totally just stared at them all.
I forget what we were doing at that point in the day, but
we were exhausted is what we were doing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, starting to see double. And then I wanted to, this is going to sound like a self-congratulatory kind of nonsense. Pure dumb luck, no skill. For the first time in however many years I've been chasing birds, I shot 2 birds in the air with one shot.
Yeah, you're talking about that.
Yeah, they were crossing, and I didn't even see the one on the right. I swung on the one on the left, butt, body, beak, bang, pulled through, bang, and it, like at that exact moment, another bird was coming in from the right-hand side, and both of them just poof,
just piled up.
Yeah, down into the rocks. It was awesome.
Hey, somebody's got to have the luck.
Yeah. Oh, that was 100% luck. Yeah. I've water swatted ducks before and done that.
Yeah.
Where two were lined up. I'd never shot chucker out of the air. One shell, two birds.
No, I've never done that. That's cool. You were on the other side of the canyon and we could see each other because I was on the other, we were on opposite canyons.
Yeah. With the goal being to just pinball them through there.
Yeah, just pinball them back and forth. But we had that big old covey.
Yeah.
That was just, I could tell you stood on that rock for like 10 minutes going, should I?
It was about to get reckless. Yeah.
It was so steep though. I knew what was going through your head. You're like, all right, I can shoot these birds,
but
then I've got to go down there and get them.
Yep.
And this is a really, really steep and shale rock hillside.
I was going to do it too. I was just going to pound them right on that rock outcropping. And then it was like, man,
I could almost hear your brain rolling like, do it.
The intrusive thoughts almost won.
But your body was like, no.
Yeah.
Bad idea.
Yeah, four kids will take the edge off any of those intrusive thoughts of like, man, I should just do this.
Yeah, I'll just parkour right down this hill.
Yeah, it'd be perfect.
It'll be fine. But you were smart. You turned around and you walked away and left those.
Dude, there's plenty out there, man. If there were a couple fellas that knew what they were doing and had some dogs, man, they would have cleaned up in there and they would have been done.
We had no dogs and we don't know what we're doing. No. So, and we still did great.
Yeah. First chucker. No, that's not true. Second chucker outing of the season for me.
Yep. Second for me as well, but it was well worth it. It was fun.
100%. So where are we at? Oh man, we got a break coming up here in a minute. Let me do a quick overview of the show. Today, couple things I wanted to talk about: field scoring animals.
Yeah.
I don't want to go too in depth with it because I don't want to make it like a trophy focused type deal, but I do think of rifle season, which is what we're entering now.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of it, mule deer, I think was
already open
Sunday.
Last week.
Okay. Yeah. So we're in rifle season now. I tend to think of rifle season as the time to really, for lack of a better term, trophy hunt. Kind of look for those bigger deer that you want. You get more opportunity to really look at them, really watch them. I don't know what that is. And I'm sure somebody listening right now is going, hey, Henry, I bow hunt. And no, that's not, I go after big deer only with a bow. I don't know, man. Maybe that's you. I tend to think of if I got a rifle in my hand, that's when I'm more willing to hold out for a bigger deer.
Yes. Not that I've never rifle hunted, but
I've
been with plenty of people that have.
Right. Right.
Being a lifetime archer.
Right.
And staring at the same animals they are when we're sitting on a saddle or on viewing location and me, I'm like, do it, and they're like, oh man, his fronts are weak. Oh, he doesn't have the mass I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Where as an archer, you're like, it's a buck.
Yeah. He's bedded. I'm doing this.
Bedded.
Yeah.
He's in a great spot. The wind's in my favor. Game's on.
I think it's the style of hunting because, to get within 300, you're like, okay, perfect.
Yeah.
And everybody's got their different tolerance. But yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about that in the upcoming segments. Is just a quick, if I see a buck, the quick little calculation I'm doing to figure out, okay, is this a good deer or is this like a fair to middling thing?
Yeah, like what are the main things you look at when you first spot the animal?
Exactly.
What is it that you look at on its antlers to tell you yay or nay?
Yep, that, and I'll do the same thing for elk, and then we'll get into a little bit of
sheep. Desert starting.
Yeah, good point, sheep. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to get into some basics with some rifle stuff as well, just recent experiences and all that, stuff you should think about, stuff that doesn't matter. So don't go anywhere. We will be right back after the break on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. And we're back on Nevada Backcountry, brought to you by Legacy Sports International, home of the Halas Superlight. What we're going to talk about in some upcoming segments here, probably after this, we'll talk a little bit about some rifle tips and tricks. There's some stuff there that I think translates to hunting, and there's some stuff that I think people waste time worrying about. On that note, let's jump into field scoring muleys real quick, Dave.
Yeah.
So first things first, you're out there, you get a rifle tag, or you're with a buddy that's got a rifle tag. Nice buck on a ridge line, you know, 500-600 yards away. What are you looking for first? What do you look at?
At that kind of a distance, I'm probably looking at his front depth.
Okay.
Depths of his front forks.
Okay.
Because that's a big chunk of scoring, is that whole entire, the front lengths.
Yep.
And the mass measurement points, that's where the most of them are. Maybe at 500-600 yards, depending on if you're using a pretty high-end scope or something, you might not get a good gauge of its mass. You might, but
yeah.
That'd probably be the first thing I would look at if I was going for the best possible score, as well as symmetry.
Just the overall frame.
Just overall frame. I mean, how symmetrical is this frame?
Yep.
You know, so.
I don't think people realize when scoring a deer or a mule deer, you know, 25% of your score is going to be based on that main beam.
Yeah.
So like you said, there's more mass measurements up front. The depth of those front tines, man, and that main beam, that's going to be where you make up a bunch of points.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the point of this segment isn't to, I don't know, I quit apologizing for it.
Yeah, like, yeah, you're not trying to deter anybody from shooting anything. If you want to shoot it, go for it.
Yeah.
Me personally, I like the weird.
Yeah, just, we've talked about that.
I like
that.
The weird
yeah.
animals. I don't care for score. To me, I just doesn't really matter. But if it's funky, if it's got a weird drop on it or antlers like twisted or something, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out there like, you know, I'm not shooting anything unless it's 170 plus, 180 plus.
Yeah.
Mule deer wise. So those are the two main things that they should, well, three main things I think they should be looking at when they're trying to determine if it is a 170 or 80 or 90 class animal is, yeah, the front forks.
Main beams,
yep. And symmetry.
And here's a quick tip. Man, if you only get a view of it going away from you, if you've looked at enough deer, you know when they're going away from you and their ears are pinned back,
they look huge.
Absolutely massive. If at all possible, I want a front view and I want a side view.
Yeah.
I can look at that tine depth and then I can see, okay, because generally speaking, if it's alert and looking forward and those ears are out, I can get a better idea of the length of the main beams, how wide it is, you know, all that. Because everything, you take like a small 3-point from the back.
Oh, man.
With his ears in, it looks giant.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, whoa, okay.
And a lot of hunters, in my experience, they always go high.
Yeah.
They always gauge high. And, you know, and that I think that's just human nature. You know, you see something like, oh, that's got to be, get to them. And there's a lot of ground shrinkage. And you're like,
bingo.
Yeah, it's a 160 plus.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Couple things. I call it like the rule of eights or whatever. So a mature mule deer, typically the ear length is going to be about 8 inches. I go with
per ear.
So ear to tip of ear, it's between 20, maybe 22 on the high side. From tip of ear to tip of ear, including the head, I go with 21 inches. That's my kind of...
That's kind of your go-to.
Everybody's got different...
You're giving eye to eye or the skull.
5 inches.
5 inches, yep. And then 8 inches on each ear.
Per ear. Yep.
Per ear.
So I look at that as 21. Some guys, I've heard 24. I've heard 20. I go with 21 for whatever reason.
Okay.
And then I know right off the bat, if I've got a front view of it, its ears are alert, and I'm going with 21 in ear to ear. If it's outside of that, I know, okay, I'm looking at a pretty good deer.
Yeah, 24, from there, 25 maybe.
Yeah, from there, then I can start to get nitpicky about stuff. I start looking at tine depth and all that. And again, I use that. If you're sitting there with a spotting scope and you can visualize that ear length as 8 inches, I can then take that and apply that all to all the tines and go, okay, that's, holy smokes, that, you know, that back looks like it's 2 ear lengths or whatever, and start going from there. That's an ear and a half, and mentally kind of adding that up. And the nice thing with a typical framed buck is I can just do one side and then double it.
Yeah, yeah. If it's nice, good to go. If you can see that it's a good symmetrical deer, you're like, yeah.
Exactly.
Just, yeah. A lot of hunters put a lot of real estate in the width. Like, oh, it has to be 30 inches.
Yeah, yeah.
30-inch deer equates to a 180 buck. And yeah. It's like, width is not a big percentage of your score.
No.
It's not. It's your...
That's that old-timey Nevada thing, yeah. Though, man. Tend to find it, like, guys over 60. They don't care. It could be 120 inches. It could be 200 inches.
Mm-hmm.
What's the width?
What's the width?
In fact, that's I think Sean Shea talked about that when he was on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. What yeah. is it? A 30-inch buck? That's what they
that?
Want.
How yeah. wide is it? Yeah. One of my biggest archery muleys, little to no mass. I mean, his mass isn't his antler from coming out of the head to the tip of, to the tips was probably no bigger than your thumb, maybe a little bit bigger than
spindly
the,
sucker.
Just yeah.
Okay.
But he was long.
Yeah.
Big fronts, big backs. He was 28, a little over 28 and a half wide. So he was
good deer.
Really good looking deer, 150s. I mean, he had no mass. He had good length, but he had no mass.
Yeah.
So you lost a whole lot of points on those mass measurements.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, so.
What do you use for mass? What's your quick? And again, all this is, I'm not talking about green scoring or getting tape to them. You know, this is more, like I said, with this rifle season, this is more like, okay, am I looking at a really good mature mule deer that I want to kill? So what do you use for mass?
Usually where it forks.
You look at that, whether or not it's webbed or any of that.
How thick it is at that point. You know, is it kind of almost like we had a deer up there in 16 that his nickname was Palms.
Okay.
Because his mass was ridiculous. Where he forked out, the first fork where he broke out, and then his next forks where he came out and made a 4x4, those points had so much mass to him, it was like the palm of your hand.
Yeah.
So he was just magnificent. So that's how I kind of look at it. If those forks are like really spindly and thin, well, then his main beams are probably going to be pretty weak as well.
Right.
Because usually that's a point that you gain the most mass because now you've got two antlers coming out of one location. So it should indicate, you know, some decent girth. Well, if it's not there, it's not going to be at the base of his head either or anywhere else. He's going to be pretty weak going through.
It's a very good point because I'm a bigger than the eye guy.
Oh, you look at his eye and kind of gauge the width of his eye is what, like maybe?
4 inches. Like it's got a 4-inch circumference.
Circumference.
So I look at it, I'm like, okay, if it's bigger than his eye, then you're getting into that like 5-6 inch circumference. Then you're talking about like he's going to have decent mass.
He's going to be good.
If he carries it. But you're absolutely right. It can be misleading looking just at the bases.
Yeah.
That's probably a better way to do it, like you were saying.
Both of them together would be pretty dialed.
If it's bigger around than his eye, it's like, okay, he's going to have decent mass. If he carries it out to the tips, perfect. Now we're talking.
Question for you is, so when you are doing this,
mm-hmm.
I have an example.
Okay.
But when you are doing this and you're field scoring this animal before you decide if you're going to take it or not, how much time do you give yourself to actually field score it before you make a decision?
Not much time at all, honestly.
Yeah.
And I think about it in chunks of 20. I'll preface all this with saying, like, I've never won one of the, like, score the things.
Oh, the belt buckle things.
Yeah,
or
at the shows.
Or shows
I've never,
or something.
I've done pretty well. I've been within an inch or two.
Yeah.
But so if I'm doing this on a mountainside, you're talking, man, a couple minutes max, depending on how long the deer gives you. And I think about it in terms of like, okay, is this a 140 class, 60 class, 80 class?
Gotcha.
If it's smaller than that, you know, it's like, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it could be 80 inches, could be 120 inches. I don't know. I'm not goofing with it.
Yeah. So you just kind of block it out. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I was with a hunter it was a while back, but the individual wanted like a high-end, high-quality muley.
Right.
He took so long trying to figure out, I got to check out its front, do this, you know. And before you knew it, the thing was gone. It was up and over a saddle and gone.
I'll shoot a 167 and 5/8, but not a 163 and 1/8.
Right. You know, yeah, so goofy it stuff. Took so long that the deer was out of range right. and then gone. And then just bitch the rest of the day because, oh, I should have taken it. I should have taken it.
Well, yeah, you probably should have, man.
Spend 35 minutes trying to make sure, you know, oh, well, the heat waves are in my way. I can't get a really good idea of its mass. And you're like, dude, just if you shoot it and it's on the ground, we can figure it out pretty quick.
Yeah. You know? Is it but, good? Yeah, no, yeah. No. It's quick so, for me, man.
I'm I was just kind of curious.
Looking at the time, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about elk and then we'll dive into some rifle stuff. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Man, the introduction to the show, the bugle we use, elk. Elk are awesome.
Elk are fantastic.
Again, this is rifle season stuff. You know, they've probably shut up. You're having to find them without resorting to calling them in at this point. Probably holding out for a little older age class animal. Dave, what do you use? You're out there. You're looking at elk. You got any cheats or tips that you use to score? I mean, like, hey, this is worth going after, or hey, let's look at something else. Not, well, there's an extra eighth here, or, you know.
Yeah.
What do you look at?
Length. You know,
if main beam.
Yeah, if their main beam is, if you know, if their head's back or straight up or something, and I can kind of draw a line like, okay, that is darn near at his rump, then we're going after that guy. Something like that. Or if his swords are really, really nice. Or I'm a guy, I really dig the fronts.
Yeah, okay.
Like if their fronts are long and then they curl up, you know, kind of do like a big old hook on it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's man, cool that's looking just, animal. That just jazzes me out.
Okay.
I'll chase that thing all day.
I use 50-50-40. 50-50-40 basically gives you a, you figure for a mature 6x6 public land elk, you're looking at basically 50 as long as it goes over halfway down the back, the main beams.
Yeah.
You're looking at about 50 inches. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that multiplied by 2 gives you 100. Then generally speaking, you're going to have about 50 inches of mass and a 40 inch inside spread. So 50-50-40 gives you a base of 190. The ears are about 10 inches long. And that's just a quick rip through all the tines, you know? And you're like, okay, you figure mature 6x6, you're talking about a couple feet for royals, 24 inches there. So if you can basically get to 75 inches, if it's a typical 6x6, 75 inches of extra tine length on each side,
yeah,
and a base of 190, you got 150, 190, you're talking about a 340 class bull.
Yeah, but 340, I mean, people in, you know, a lot of us in Nevada have gotten pretty spoiled at seeing.
Oh, things. Yeah.
You know, yeah. You go to a lot of other states and they, 340 is like Nevada's 390.
Oh, yeah. No, a 340 coming out of public land in Montana.
You kidding me?
Is unreal.
It's unreal. Yeah. Idaho, Wyoming, you see a 340 bull, that you got about two, three other people staring at that thing too.
Yeah.
It's like a race.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Nevada.
We're limited Walk entry. On. And that's why I said, so I guarantee there's somebody, you know, probably like Sage or Dalton from Unbranded Outfitters.
Yeah.
Those guys probably have a much more realistic system for looking at limited entry Nevada bulls.
Yeah. Oh,
you know
for
what
sure.
I mean?
Yeah. I mean, well, their sister Aspen shot us
360 ish.
Bomber.
Yeah.
Bomber bullish.
Yeah.
50-50-40.
50-50-40 gives you a base of 190. And then, like I said, if you can use that ear, which is about 10 inches on a mature bull, a herd bull.
Yeah, to help you gauge time
then,
length.
Yeah, then just rip through the fronts, go up, you know, look at the things, and you figure, okay, oh, holy smokes, I got to, let's say even 60 extra inches. 120 plus 190, you're there, man. I'd take that thing. A 310 bull?
Yeah, that's,
take it.
Yeah. I wonder if there is an algorithm to combine your 50-50-40 to my hillbilly technique.
No, it's not hillbilly technique,
my
man.
My dirt kicking way.
I think part of it too is you probably, not probably, you have looked at a lot more elk than I have. I try to shorten that learning curve. You know what I mean? I don't got the miles. So I try to shorten that learning curve, but that's my quick field score for elk. Obviously a big bulk of the score, or a good chunk of the score, not bulk, chunk of the score is going to be that spread.
Yeah, that spread.
Yeah, that's why you have those, Michaela something or other. She shot a really nice, at first blush, it doesn't look that big.
Is that the muzzleloader one?
No, it was an archery. I met her at one of the shows and was chatting with her. Hmm. At first glance, what strikes you about her bowl was the width.
Oh, okay. Now
it's super wide. Yeah, it doesn't.
Now I remember.
From a mile away.
Yeah.
Yeah. A mile away, you'd be like, I don't know. That's eh. But then when you see it up close and you realize how freaking wide the thing is, you realize that's where most of the score came from.
Yeah. That thing was, I do remember.
Super wide.
Now. Yeah.
Goofy looking thing.
Sometimes get lucky.
Get lucky. Yeah.
Get real lucky.
Not me. Not this guy. Wide rack, long main beams, big score.
Yeah. And plus, elk are just a blast to be around.
Yes.
Yeah. If you're out there during the bugle, my nephews were just up in Oregon hunting elk, archery, and we just had dinner a couple nights ago, and they were like trying to explain to me how they knew the elk size based on the elk's vocalization, like depth and chuckle and length and all this. I'm like, I don't know if that's a thing.
I will steal someone else's story. I think that's a thing if you're one of these guys from a state where you can hunt over-the-counter elk every single year and you've grown up doing it. So on my dad's Utah, my dad was fortunate enough to draw that Monroe Mountain unit in Utah. This goes back 6-7 years now, something like that. Maybe not that long. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But those guides that grew up on that mountain and know that herd of elk, they are much more in tune with how those elk, and it doesn't have to be how each individual, but just that herd in general, how they vocalize. And my dad said it was interesting to watch those guys because they would be selective based on how the elk bugled, on whether or not it was worth going after.
Oh, okay.
Now, because, you know, my dad, coming from Nevada, limited entry stuff and everything, he was like, hey, they're lighting up, they're bugling, let's go for it. And they'd be like, nah, you know, it's a deep. And he said what was funny is they weren't going after the ones that bugled real deep. They were looking for like a thin, kind of raspy sounding bugle.
Like the smoker elk?
What's the smoker elk?
Oh, the one that smokes?
Oh, it's the one, raspy. Yeah.
Raspy.
The Marlboro elk.
Elk. There you go. Camel non-filtered elk.
Yeah. Sure enough, I mean, they heard the bull he wound up killing. That bull lit up, and my dad said it did not sound like a big bull, but they said, no, that's what we're going after that. Let's get aggressive. And they went down in this thing after it, and sure enough, it was like a 360 and change bull.
Oh, okay. So there is something to...
I don't know if I buy it coming from Nevada, though.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I don't think we know enough. I mean, I don't want to sell anybody short in the state.
Yeah.
But I think there's a different group of elk hunters out there that's all they do. They've grown up and they kill multiple elk every single year, day in and day out. Like, that's what they do.
Yeah.
I think maybe I'd buy it in those cases.
Huh. Yeah, well, I guess, if I was with a guy that's been on that mountain for a decade or two, it's like, well, I'm going to, whatever you say, man.
Yeah. If you think that's worth going after.
I'm following you.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But if I was out there on my own and I heard like a real deep, nasty, growly like bugle, and then I heard one that sounded like somebody stepping on a cat, I'd be like,
I'm going for the
growly one. He sounds bigger and cooler, I guess.
What was your nephew's take? What are they saying?
More of the deep, growly,
interesting.
With the chuckle at the end.
Yeah.
You know, your traditional chuckle at the end.
Right.
That was kind of like their signal that was a bruiser.
Hmm.
And I was like, well, I, you know.
It'd be interesting, like a Jason Phelps that, or even, gosh, I bet Tim would. Tim's an Idaho guy. Burnett.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tim might know based on how they vocalize in Idaho. But yeah, like I said, unless it's somebody that grew up with that herd of elk and on that mountain, I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know, man.
And it could be regional and, and, you know, all kinds of different things. I mean, birds have all different songs. They may be the same bird, a tanager or something, but depending on location, they'll have different song and different mating calls,
just
different dialects. So
I don't know.
It was kind of curious. I just,
who's the, let's try to get an elk biologist on.
Yeah. We'll get a hold of him and see if he wants to come on.
Yeah. I'd like to get an elk biologist on.
And then a speech pathologist. A little mix there. Like,
For me. You know,
speech.
Why do I use the same one-liners all the time? Let's take a break. Hey, hit the refill button on the coffee. We will be back momentarily on Nevada Backcountry. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.
And we have returned to Nevada Backcountry. Right now, I think we're going to get ourselves into a little bit of rifle talk.
Let's do it. And let's do like general overview stuff.
Total general.
Yeah. Because we were talking off air. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole. Look, it's last segment. I don't want to end on a negative note, but, but there's some things. First, before I get to that, hey, Out West Buildings, Truck Envy, Legacy Sports International, support the people that bring you this content. Phenomenal sponsors, a little something for everybody out there. We won't go too far into it, or we won't go into it at all. But Dave, you had some truck issues. Should have gotten outfitted at Truck Envy. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I don't know if your issues would have been solved at Truck Envy.
No,
this last
they
trip.
Would have not been solved at Truck Envy. Would have rolled that thing in there. They would have said, what?
Take it out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Move it out of here.
So now rifle stuff.
Yeah.
Man, we were chatting off air, and I don't know if it's the personality thing that's drawn to extreme precision with rifle stuff, but there's an obsession over minutia that at the end of the day, I don't think puts animals on the ground. And I'm going to use an example. You will get people that obsess over, they'll weigh each piece of brass when it comes to reloading. They want specific lot numbers for primers. They'll look for a certain lot number. And then they go to the range and they shoot off a lead sled, or they shoot off a bipod sitting at a shooting bench in a nice comfy padded chair.
Yeah.
And they get these teeny tiny little groups and they go, oh, perfect. It's like a confirmation bias. Everything added up to this. You know, the reason I shot that teeny tiny group was because I got this lot number primer, yada, 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 yada. They'll never take the time to go do 50 jumping jacks and then drop down in the dirt and shoot from the prone, or do a couple wind sprints and then throw their pack down and sit behind it and try to shoot off their pack. Suddenly, all that obsession over the minutia of the thing is a 5-inch group just because they've never practiced shooting offhand.
Right.
And it's like, well, what's the point? You know, if you got a 5-inch group at 100, you're talking about a 10-inch group at 200. You're talking about a clean miss all day long at 3, which 300 should be in the realm of every rifle shooter out there.
Yeah,
if you put the focus into the right stuff. So a couple things I wanted to hit on now that that's out of the way. Put the time in. It's rifle season now. You guys are going out and gals are going out. Do yourself a favor, shoot offhand, shoot off your pack, shoot at an awkward angle on a hillside or something, you know, because that's what you're going to wind up doing. Well,
and that's the beauty, and I know I'm going to be tapping the bell of archery, but that's the beauty of archery and getting to go to these 3D tournaments and all of that, because you're not shooting off a sled or a table or some comfortable location.
Indoor
where someone's bringing you a cocktail. It just doesn't happen. I mean, you're shooting between trees. You're shooting downhill, uphill. You're shooting, you can't do a competition shoot with rifles.
Well, you can. Remember Jim Irwin, Performance Shooting Institute, when we had him on, my buddy Jim from Gardnerville.
Right.
He is starting that down there out in Smith Valley, where he does a like a hunting like a course. Yeah.
Yeah. See, now anyone with a rifle, get in touch with him and get involved in that, because that's going to teach you how to shoot these oddball positions or prone or sitting down on a tripod,
kneeling, all
or
this stuff,
whatever it is, because that's all going to have an effect on how well you're going to group.
Oh, absolutely.
All day long. So, because I know there's a lot of people, like you said, that just obsess about, like they'll file things so that each bullet weighs the identical, not just like a half a grain off. They're like identical, but you know, my second dad, which he's the one introduced me to the outdoors. He had a Sears and Roebuck 270, and he would shoot Federal right out of the box, or heck, sometimes whatever was on sale. I mean, we're talking, this is the 70s and 80s. It's just you bought what was available. He could tack drive things at 300, 400, 500 yards all day long.
Yeah.
And it's just stuff like he would just pull a bullet out of the out of a box. I mean, yeah, granted, they're all 150 grain, but they could be Federals. They might be, you know, whatever brand.
Yeah.
Whenever people got that like super duper crazy technical, I'd always think about Raymond and be like, he just grab a bullet out of his pocket. He didn't know where it came from.
Yeah. Some now the you hunting know? Jacket and it would go and stick it bang, in and then flop.
Boom and flop. And you're like, okay,
perfect.
You know, so
right off the bat, and this came up recently, but look, I don't care if you're zeroing at the bottom of Death Valley and then hunting at the top of Wheeler.
Right.
It's going to be, elevation is going to be such a negligible difference for big game hunting.
Yeah.
It ain't going to matter. Yeah. So for most people listening right now, take elevation, throw it out the window, because most of you are going to be zeroing rifles at, let's say, between 4 and 6,000 feet.
Yeah.
That's where most of the population in Nevada lives. Yeah. 4,000, 6,000 feet. At most, you're going to be hunting at, what's Wheeler? 13?
13, right at 13,000.
At the absolute, let's say you were shooting a buck at the very tippy top of Wheeler. You're at 13,000 feet. Difference between, sake of argument, we'll say 5,000 feet, 13,000 feet, within 400 yards, it's not going to equate to a miss. So don't worry about it.
No, you're only talking, what, 2 inches?
At most, it's basically, it works out to 1% per 1,000 feet or 9% at 10,000 feet difference. Yeah, so it's not, again, if you put the crosshairs where they're supposed to go and you've practiced shooting offhand, off a bat, off your backpack, kneeling, whatever, it's not going to make a difference, man. You're going to put holes in the thing.
Yeah. Hit the shooting dirt. Sticks, what have you.
Yep. It'll hit the dirt. So same thing with temperature. Same thing with humidity.
Yeah.
They are negligible amounts of difference. And I know somebody listening right now, yes, you can mathematically, you could prove me wrong, I guess. Look, I obsessed over this stuff at a certain point in my life because it was my career. In certain instances, being able to perform this stuff under pressure meant life or death. I understand that obsession with the minutiae. It does not apply out in the woods to big game hunting.
So would you say the biggest thing that applies would be fatigue from hiking the mountains and then coming up and finding animals, and you just got done hiking 2.5 miles and you're a little winded, a little sore.
Awkward shooting position,
laying on the side of a mountain.
Yes.
And you're trying to figure out how to, you know, if you're having to fart around and move around a ton just to like see clearly through your scope, that could be a problem.
That's going to be a problem. If you're going straight into the sun and you know there's going to be glare, get some elevation. So you're looking down on whatever you're shooting at.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You got to get elevation because you got to be looking down at it. You don't want to be looking up the hill towards the sun.
Yeah.
So there's all that little stuff. I would say absolutely, though. You're right. Like just that being able to shoot when your heart rate's a little elevated, you're fatigued, and shooting in an awkward position. You know what? Go force yourself. Go to a range and do nothing but shoot offhand standing up. It's not going to be sexy. It's not going to be fun. Now your uber expensive rifle that was shooting a bug hole at 100 yards, now you're shooting like a 7-inch group at 100 yards. Hey, get that 7-inch group down to maybe a 2-inch group offhand at 100. Now we're in the money.
Yeah. Well, I got to get my Hawa 308 out.
Yeah. Did you get it back?
Yeah.
Gina didn't steal it forever?
Well, placed it somewhere where she may not find it. She has a 6.5 Grendel.
That's right.
And the 243, but she keeps grabbing my Hawa 308.
Let me back up for a second. Another, I got a bone to pick with this too.
Uh-oh.
The numbers printed on a box of factory ammo are never correct. They are never correct. Those are generally done in a climate-controlled test tunnel with a 26-inch barrel, perfect 70 degrees, 28% humidity, whatever. Like, that's how those they calculate those numbers on a box of ammunition.
Oh, I've never even looked at that.
Yeah, well, good. Don't. No, so it'll say like, oh, if you zero 1.5 inches high at 100 yards, your drop will be this at this yardage, blah, 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 blah. That's like, I've never found a box of factory ammunition that I then took out, shot through a chronograph, which everybody should have if you're reloading, and had it even be within 100 feet per second of what the box says it is.
Yeah.
But anyway, just go out, shoot offhand. Don't obsess over the minutia, guys and gals. On that note, Dave, anything else?
No, I think I got to start shooting more.
Yeah, you got to read the box.
Read the box would help.
All right. Yeah, maybe read the box. Maybe don't. I don't know. Yeah. But thank you sincerely to everybody for tuning in this weekend. Next week, let's dive a little bit into the commission stuff.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right.
Good stuff.
Coming up next, Tom Gresham's Gun Talk.